Okay, I might start soon. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Today's topic is about cyber insurance and cyber risk and cyber insurance. Should I get that right? If you're here to know more about the notifiable breach, which is going to be in place tomorrow in the wrong room, please go back to your company and send the right person here. But today it's about cyber insurance. A couple of housekeeping. This session is recorded by a webinar, so and is live. So if you've got any questions, please speak to the mic, so make sure people online can hear it. And also, apologies from Ben Richardson, who is the underwriter and is the co-author of this presentation. He can't join us today. Without holding up too much, I'm going to introduce you to Peter Yit. Peter is an associate director in EY, and he had experience in group risk role in QBE. And he had a role in chief risk officer in the Lloyd's syndicate before, many years experience in GI and the weather field actuarial. So let's now welcome Peter to give us the session. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Cyber risk is a huge, huge field. So we've only got an hour. So this is going to be a bit of a gallop through. So apologies to anyone who wants to know more about their favorite specific detail. This is sort of a survey, if you like. There are some presentations by the Cyber Insurance Working Group, which has got more guts around the insurance side of it. What I'm here today really to say is cyber risk is an area which is becoming increasingly important, both on the insurance side, but also for the corporates who are buying that insurance and are trying to manage cyber risk. And it's a great opportunity for actuaries to get involved. It's very easy up front to feel like, hell, I don't know anything about, you know, cyber or technology or, you know, the latest whiz-bang vulnerability that someone's dug into the bowels of a CPU and discovered a CPU within a CPU or whatever it is today. It's very easy to be intimidated by all of that, but the reality is the field is new, is changing very fast. And actuaries can bring a lot of sort of big picture risk management ideas and disciplines to it. Maybe not as quantitative, we'll come to that in a second, but actuaries can make a valuable contribution. So let's get going. We're going to talk a bit briefly about attacker profiles and the threats they pose. Dive briefly, touch on economics. Talk about data breaches, very topical tomorrow. Ransomware, then we'll finally get to cyber insurance. I want to touch on breaking up of silos. We'll talk briefly about supply chains. We'll talk about quantification and risk factors, and then some key takeaways for you all. Okay, if you've seen anything on cyber, you've probably seen this kind of list of potential attackers before. Roughly speaking, there's a lot of sound at the moment about nation-state attackers, whether it's Russia hacking whoever in America, or Russia trying to influence elections, etc., etc., etc. We've got cyber criminals. We've got hacktivists who probably haven't had quite as much airplay in the last few months. What we're looking at here is almost a progression from very well-resourced, very capable actors who've got a lot of resource to throw at targeted, persistent attacks. Cyber criminals who are very, very driven by economics, and we'll talk a bit more about them later on, and hacktivists who are very often looking for an easy win, some publicity, some attention, and not that they're not problematic in their own right. Reputation is very important these days, but they have different characteristics from the other two. Right, so those are the sort of big scary threats, but if you've been watching the news, you will have seen the cabinet files. You know, this is good old someone's filing cabinet. They sold it, it was still full of classified documents. You know, the oldest thing in the book, I left the papers on the train type of thing. So for all the sort of sound and noise about sexy attacks and cyber this and the Russians that, organizations are still very, very vulnerable to unencrypted laptops, unencrypted USBs, leaving papers on the train, you know, this filing cabinet thing. Similarly, the old insider attack. You know, Snowden's probably the poster child still, but the Panama Papers we've seen, Swiss tax haven leaks, and on and on and on. So these are kind of less cybery, but they're the same sort of threat, the same sort of danger to organisations. I'm not going to go into an exhaustive list of ways that organisations can be attacked. I'll just touch on three that we'll kind of come back to a few times in the course of this. Data breaches, particularly from an insurance point of view, it's the sort of the archetypal cyber loss. Ransomware has probably had more of a profile in Australia for a longer time than it has overseas. And business interruption. So business interruption, again, is something that's playing out a bit in some of the cyber scenarios, for example, that Lloyd's have built. And it's very adjacent to, you know, it's just another kind of business interruption that clients are going to want insurance coverage for. Okay, economics. So this is when we start to say, yes, it's a technology problem, but no, it's not a technology problem. So why are cyber criminals doing these things? They're doing these things because they want to make a living. They're doing these things because they want money. So yes, you have a data breach up front, but always remember that you have to go from the data breach to how does a cyber criminal turn that into money, into cash in their bank account. It's a little bit like, you know, the sort of chain around crime and money laundering and that sort of thing, sanctions, that kind of thing. It's a series of events. Good example of that is ransomware. Ransomware essentially is where your computer gets locked or your system gets locked and encrypted, and you have to pay a ransom to get it unencrypted. Now, that's effectively been made possible by the advent of cryptocurrencies. So without those, you'd be, you know, putting a check in the mail and sending it to somebody. From an attacker's point of view, that's quite laborious. Similarly, something we've seen in the last few months, really, is attackers, rather than installing actively malicious software on websites or servers or using them in botnets, they've simply installed crypto mining software. So you go and visit a web page and your computer's busy spinning CPU cycles mining Bitcoin. We'll talk about supply chain later, but it's a very hard thing to stop. But again, this is a question of I've breached your server, I've breached your website, how do I turn that into cash? How do I make a living out of it? I'm not just doing it for fun, I'm doing it as a job. This is a, you know, it's a profession. Even if we're talking about someone seeking to, you know, a nation state, for example, or someone seeking just to do malicious damage, they're still going to be thinking about how do I do the most damage with the capabilities or with the effort that I've got, or the resources that I've got. So at first glance, this stuff might look random, but when you start to dig down, there are underlying themes. There are reasons why people are doing the things they're doing. There are reasons why there are trends changing over time and why the attacks and the vulnerabilities and issues from last year or the year before are not going to be next year's ones. Even down to the level of the exploits, the computer vulnerabilities that a lot of this stuff is predicated on, there is an active market for it. There is an active legitimate market as well as an active black market. You know, it started a while ago with bug bounties, but it's a very active market. So there are businesses that set out to identify and build the chain of code and capabilities needed to exploit these vulnerabilities and then sell them. So when I say, you know, this is not a technology question, and actuaries can potentially bring quite a bit to this, this is the kind of perspective I'm bringing. You know, there are rational reasons for doing these things, there are economic reasons for doing these things, in the same way that the rest of our financial services system works. Okay, data breaches. So back to insurance for a second. So in the insurance world, a data breach is the sort of archetypal attack. It's the archetypal product that we insure. The reason for this is basically the Americans have been doing it, you know, for more than a decade. So they brought in legislation which said, if you are hacked, if you lose data, personal data, healthcare data, then you have an obligation to notify the people whose data it was. Now, varied state by state, it came in over time, got more it got stronger. Shareholder class actions, you know, came into play, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But effectively, this is the reason why, people with an insurance background, will think data breach is the first port of call. Obviously, it's rolling out. Anyone who has anything to do with the EU will know it's rolling out later this year in the EU and in Australia tomorrow. So the Australian requirements are relatively soft in terms compared to some of the overseas ones. From an actuary's point of view, from a quantitative point of view, it's great because suddenly we've got data. Suddenly we've got we don't necessarily have perfect exposure data, but we've got some degree of consistent reporting of these breaches. It's a little bit like looking for your keys under the lamppost, whereas you drop them, you know, 50 metres down the road, but it is at least some data that we can see that gives us some ideas of breach characteristics. Okay, I touched on ransomware before, but I also mentioned that Australia has been was one of the countries that saw it quite early, possibly because with ransomware you don't have geographical restrictions. So a Bitcoin is a Bitcoin is a Bitcoin. No one has to set up a if they're stealing card details, they have to set up some sort of operation to monetize Australian credit cards. And there'll be, you know, some differences to doing that to American credit cards. They might get a poorer price. So something like ransomware, cryptocurrencies, it travels across geographies much better. It's quite interesting because you've gone from sort of, if you like, a big data breach to lots of small encryptions of people's hard drives. And you're aiming to get people to say, yes, I will pay you what's effectively like a service fee. So you're trying to set a ransom, you know, in the hundreds or thousands of dollars that people will pay without, you know, without arguing too much. It may even be better, easier than restoring from backup. And it's also in some versions of ransomware have looked very much like a service model where they've had, you know, helplines and sort of helping people decrypt their files. So, you know, back to the sort of, this is a business. Make no mistake, this is a business. So as someone who's doing ransomware, you're trying to help people decrypt their hard drives. Because if someone says, oh yeah, I got that, you know, it was impossible to do, just throw the computer away and get a new one, then they won't pay the ransom. So there's no payback to the cyber criminal. And yeah, we've mentioned cryptocurrency is the key to the value chain. So if we roll forward a couple of years and cryptocurrencies kind of vanish and no payment mechanism has taken their place, then ransomware may well, you know, vanish or evolve in some way. Because that's part of the sort of part of the value chain for that attack. Right. So cyber insurance. So cyber insurance evolved with the American data breach notification requirements. So effectively what happened was the American companies were finding they'd lost a lot of records. Suddenly they had to communicate with everyone, they had to get lawyers involved, they had to get PR involved, they had to liaise with regulators, and the numbers started to add up. So they wanted to buy insurance against this. And so this is where the traditional cyber insurance policy in America has evolved, primarily focused on the sort of, you know, S&P 500 type of companies, the very large companies or companies who sort of saw themselves as having very high exposure to personal data or payment card data. So that was what the product was built on. Over time, what's happened is people have started to realize there are gaps in existing covers, either because there was uncertainty and exclusions were put in to carve this out, or the world was simply changing. And that's where the cyber product started to expand and started to offer things like potentially loss of income, cyber extortion expenses. But something else was happening. A little bit like perhaaps travel insurance, there was a response function because companies were getting hacked and they'd never had experience with cybercrime before. They were also looking to their insurers to say, hey, what do I do in this situation? You know, which lawyers have experience in this? And so as part of the large corporate packages, there was a support in terms of legal privilege, because there are a lot of lawsuits, but also support in terms of quick response, in terms of forensic experts, etc. Now, bearing in mind what I've just said, that this evolved for very large corporates. Now, it's not clear, and it's not clear to me how well this scales in the long term down to you and I, frankly. As a consumer, would you buy a motor policy that carved out, you know, problems with the software in your car? You know, like it or not, our cars run on software. That's what the Volkswagen Dieselgate scandal showed us, that you can go in there, change the software, and you completely change the functionality of your car. So, you know, would you buy a car insurance policy? You said, oh yeah, we'll cover your car, but not if there's anything wrong with the engine management system or the electronic braking programs or anything like that. That's back to your problem. You know, would you buy a house and contents policy which excluded anything to do with your your anything electronic in your home, essentially? So what worked at the large corporate end in the long term may well not work at the consumer level. Quite aside from the questions about self-driving cars, I think there's a very real question that we will see of how sustainable some of the stuff is at the consumer level, and therefore where in the middle is the swap over? You know, SME, you know, medium-sized corporate, where do you cross over? And this is not just from an underwriting point of view, it's also from a claims handling point of view. So if I've had a car accident, how much time, how much effort is an insurer going to put into, yes, they might check the telematics to sort of see, you know, was I driving too fast, was I, you know, who was at fault or something like that, but to what extent is there going to be a kind of a deep dive into, was my car hacked, etc. And that may well evolve with the, with the responsibility of the car manufacturers. So it's a very complex area, but it's not clear that from a consumer point of view, something that carves out cyber separately from our lives is actually going to meet consumer expectations. Is going to be, you know, tenable, is going to be suitable for like handling routine claims. And there's a cost benefit trade-off. You know, there's also a trade-off going on between what you physically have and what's sitting in the cloud somewhere. And the Amazon Echo is a classic example. You've got a little speaker and a little microphone sitting in your house, and you say, you know, Alexa, I want you to book an appointment next week. You know, it goes off into the cloud, does its voice recognition, hooks up with your calendars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then comes back and says, yes, Peter, I booked your appointment at this restaurant at, you know, 6 o'clock next week. So the boundaries between, you know, what's sitting in my house and what's sitting in the cloud somewhere are blurring. So again, there's a lot of sort of silos that are getting that we think of things in, both in the insurance industry, but also when we're talking to our clients about risk sort of outside of that. which are just getting demolished. Or, I'd argue, have already been demolished and we're just catching up, frankly. The amount of stuff that's going on in the cloud that we kind of don't realize is going on in the cloud is incredible. Let's go back for a second. That also applies in terms of geographical boundaries. We're used to thinking about general insurance perils and doing sort of cat scenarios about windstorms and earthquakes. And we go back, get to our database, exposure database, and say, okay, where is this building? What's it built out of? You know, is it one story? Is it two stories? If it's a plant of some kind, has it got a bund wall around it? You know, what's the elevation? Will it flood? All of these kind of things. Cyber risk doesn't really care where something is. A lot of these attacks are sort of potentially global. Some of them might be focused on a data center in a particular location. But if you ever try asking your corporate services, which data center are my files sitting on, it takes a long time to get to the bottom of that chain. So for global insurers or for agencies who are writing Australian business back to overseas insurers, suddenly you've potentially burst this whole thing open. You know, the diversification between countries starts to look a little bit more shaky. You know, maybe diversification between industries is better than countries. At the moment, where you're focusing on data breach regulations and that sort of notification, you've certainly got diversification by different regulations in different countries and where people respond. And, you know, the Americans might be more expensive if you've lost their data, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, all of those things that we take for granted about separate insurance entities in different countries having different silos of risk, you know, it's not something we can take for granted any longer. Okay. Oops. I've got a duplicate there on the right hand side. On the left hand side, the other thing that sort of the corollary of this for general insurers is also up till now a lot of aggregation has been focused on pure cyber, and a lot of the regulated questions have been, you know, do you write cyber business or business with a cyber element? You know, a little, like it's got a little badge sitting on it. But actually a lot of other business may have exposure to cyber. You might have a cyber exclusion, which was written in the 80s, early 90s, you know, effectively from most people's point of view, pre-internet. That may not be effective. You may have a policy where, in practice, if it's a consumer policy, it may not be reputationally able to be enforced, or it may cost too much on a claim-by-claim basis to actually enforce it. So silent cyber is something that general insurers have to get their head around and make decisions as to whether, you know, are we going to accept that risk? Are we going to put an exclusion in and try and write it separately? And back to my silos are breaking slide for a second. From a pure risk premium point of view, cyber insurance premiums in Australia are probably around the, I don't know, 20 million mark, let's say. The total quantum of the risk premium is probably quite small, and, you know, may well stay relatively small compared to a lot of other risks. Where it starts to get interesting is cyber risk aggregates in different ways. And so from an actuarial point of view, you know, okay, it might not be the biggest dollar, but the way these perils aggregate across your portfolio is quite different. The way it breaks up silos that you'd previously assumed were kind of nice and separate, are quite different. So from an actuarial point of view, that's where it gets quite interesting on the insurance side. Right. Okay, so jumping back to cyber risk itself again for a second. One of the things that there's been a bit of work done from a exposure management, from a a liability catastrophe modelling point of view, has been looking at supply chains and connections between industries. And Predicat has done some interesting work around this, looking at trade between different industry groupings. And a similar thing is going on with cyber risk. Everyone's part of someone else's supply chain. And with cyber, that's just as true. So, you know, we all use computer processes from a very small number of manufacturers, probably an even smaller number of designers behind that. So you use someone else's supply chain, you are part of someone else's supply chain. So when we were talking about nation state actors, you might be sitting there going, oh, you know, that's not my problem. I'm not doing anything, you know, super secret. But actually, you might be part of the supply chain of someone who is part of the supply chain of someone doing something like that. So I've got some examples up there. So obviously, software libraries often get used in other applications bundled up into the ultimate application. Mobile phone providers have had attacks because, you know, with a nice two-factor authentication, you get texted a code. If someone someone does a SIM swap, so basically takes over your mobile phone, suddenly that two-factor authentication is compromised. So, you know, that's an example where you're looking for a fairly high-value target. But if you've got if an attacker is, you know, we talked about nation states before. If an attacker is targeting someone specifically, whether it's a nation state or it's a competitor or something like that, and you're in the supply chain, that is a risk. And similarly, when you're trying to secure your organization, you need to look back down your supply chain and say, okay, it's not just am I vulnerable, who are my suppliers, are they vulnerable, where could this compromise be? I think the overall message here is, you know, you go back 10 or 20 years ago, people were, with cyber risk, people were of the mindset that, you know, we mustn't get hacked. We don't want to get breached. You know, the reality is we've moved from a world we don't want to get breached to when we get breached, we want to minimize the damage. We want to detect it as soon as possible. We want to respond as best we can, and we want to mitigate and manage the damage. You know, Edward Snowden walked out with all the NSA documents. You know, at some point you have to say, well, you know, if these guys or the Office of Personnel Management in the US with all the classified personnel records, you know, if those sort of organizations are getting hacked, you have to sort of say, well, what makes us so special? Why are we, you know, special that we're not going to lose anything? So you then move on to, okay, yes, we need to try and minimize the chances of that and minimize the impact. We also need to detect, we need to respond, et cetera, et cetera. So, which is a mindset change. And, you know, we do it for other types of risk. So, right, how are we doing for time? Okay. Quantification. So you're all sitting there going, so where are the numbers? Where are the numbers, Peter? Okay. Quantification is hard. The probabilities of attacks. So at the moment, a lot of companies have very strong incentives not to disclose they've been breached because it impacts their reputation. You know, people they might provide services to say, oh, I'd rather use the other someone else. So we end up with partial reporting. You know, when something happens to be made public, we find out about it. Otherwise, it sort of stays under the radar. Another sort of a factoid, which is a Ponemon data breach report. You know, it's just about data breaches, which, as I've said, like, is just a tiny chunk, but we are looking under the lamppost where there is light, even if the keys are, you know, down the road. And when we look under the lamppost, we see that the mean time to detection, mean, median, one of the two, is 200 days for a data breach. So there's a big lag there. 200 days, you know, it's more than 6 months, which suggests that if there's a very long tail on that, there will be plenty of people who've been breached years ago and still haven't realized it. I think Equifax came back and said, oh, actually, it was worse than we originally thought recently. So in terms of understanding the data, understanding probabilities, that complicates things. When we do hear about them, there's a lack of detail in terms of exactly what it was, what the mechanism was, et cetera, et cetera. And exposure, you know, what's our exposure basis? I don't think anyone's quite got their head around, you know, payroll, revenue, et cetera, number of customer records, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But this is why I'm saying, you know, mandatory breach reporting, whilst data breaches are only a small part of the equation, from an actuarial point of view, it's like, yay, we've got data. It's not really what the regulators set out to do, but from an impact point of view, again, most of the reporting is pretty unsatisfactory in terms of trying to quantify how big a breach it was, or how significant the damage was. And again, insurers coming to the party and people putting in insurance claims will start to put a bit of data around that. And also often you get an initial report and then they go off and do all the work and do all the remediation, and you never really hear what the ultimate number was. The usual challenges with any sort of operational risk is, you know, putting stuff into frameworks, getting consistent definitions, etc. And again, lack of exposure basis and tying the losses back to an exposure basis. So, you know, there's lots of bad news, particularly in terms of if you're sitting down to price some insurance. So where people end up usually is relative risk factors and directional indicators. So, you know, have people kept their servers up to date? Are they running old versions? Are they running unpatched versions of software, et cetera, et cetera? So things like the Panama Papers came out and, you know, people were writing reports saying, hey, yeah, it's not surprising they got hacked or whatever. They were running an old version of this and this wasn't patched and blah, 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 blah. So again, in terms of risk assessment, and a lot of this can be done externally, so there's an organisation called Science, and there are other organisations, and BitSight, basically looking from outside, going and looking at people's web pages and saying, you know, most web pages return some information about the servers they were served on, or the software they were provided on, the content management systems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, can be inferred, and that gives them some indication of risk. Again, it's relative risk compared to their peers in the industry, compared to the country, yada, 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 yada. So it's not absolute risks like we're trying to price hurricane cover. Network traffic analysis, similarly, darknet activity. So if you've stolen some account credentials or some email details and you're trying to sell them on the darknet, people can search for those, people can potentially pick them up and identify, look, their credentials for this organisation floating around on the dark web, you know, that's potentially indicative that they've got some challenges, some problems. Similarly, the inputs there are your indications of risk issues, relative risk factors. There is some information we can get about losses, as we talked about, you know, news traffic about organisations, you know, when they do actually report losses, when you can actually get quantification. The same darknet activity when a breach actually occurs. Again, this stuff has to get solved. There is a chain there, and sometimes you can get visibility of that. And then back to things like Ponemon benchmarking surveys from providers who've provided services and pooled information. So regulators and countries want to, in an ideal world, would like some sort of information sharing. Part of the challenge is there are so many threats, there's so much noise about this vulnerability, that vulnerability, this attack, that attack, trying to filter it and say, all this threat information, what does it actually mean? And again, that's where I'm sort of saying to you, as an actuary, you might be saying, look, I'm not a technologist, I don't know how to use Amazon Web Services, I don't know all of these things, but actually in some ways that lets you, helps you see the big picture. and sort of, you know, bring a framework to try and create some order, create some sort of systematic ways of thinking about these things, rather than sort of the day-to-day, you know, drama around, you know, the next attack, the next vulnerability. Some quick examples of, I suppose, sort of relative risk factors. On the left, this is from a BitSight report, basically looking at different industries and the proportion of companies who are running servers with software which is no longer supported by the vendors. So it's a good indication. You know, it doesn't tell you exactly how vulnerable they are, but it's an indication that they've got exposures and vulnerabilities that may come back down the line. Similarly, Ponemon have got a very long-running cost of data breach study, and again, they're looking at per capita record lost, what sort of costs we're talking about. One health warning there, if you are working with that, and when I put the paper up online, you'll there's a URL there, costs are not linear with numbers of records lost. Not surprisingly, but you hear it quoted per capita all the time. If you're actually trying to do some quantitative work around this, you want to do a little bit more digging and just take that into account. From an insurance point of view, there's been some excellent work done, particularly in the UK. Lloyds have done some great stuff. So Business Blackout, the Northeast US Electricity Grid, a great paper by Lloyds, kind of goes through the insurance losses from a cyber scenario. There's something on the UK electricity grid, it's not nearly as good. So there are a bunch of different scenarios there. AIR, RMS are working on cyber models, but at the moment scenarios are probably the best place to start. RMS are working with Cambridge University, and there are a bunch of papers coming out of there which are also worth looking at. Conscious of time. So key takeaways: cyber risk is difficult to avoid. It's becoming ubiquitous. There's a continuous stream of new vulnerabilities. So it's not these aren't one off. They won't get fixed. And suddenly everything will be secure. This is a process, not making the world secure. And it's, you're part of a supply chain. Any organization is part of a supply chain. So no one sort of stands by themselves as an island. And that's why I think those kind of stories is why it's about detection, it's about response, it's about having a plan. It's not just about stopping it from happening in the first place. At a personal level, don't be put off by not being a cyber expert. The boundaries are blurring here. There's no one who's got an established practice across all of this. It needs lots of different points of view, and there aren't mature tools. So it's a very much a ripe area for getting involved in. You won't get precise numbers. You won't get everything you want. The information won't be all there. Yes, we'll leave it at that. Questions? No questions? No one? Elaine.
Hi, Elaine Gross from the Actuaries Institute. So I guess for me, this is all fantastic information. I guess in terms of even the quantification, do you think that actuaries can assist in, I guess, coming up with a framework that can help quantify where we don't get lost in the detail? Because I think that's what your point is that actually when you look at all the experts in these areas, they're so kind of so obviously sucked into the detail that it's not like that there is one obvious person who's looking at it from a high level, and that potentially we can bring some of those frameworks, risk management frameworks, with high level back of the envelope quantification to kind of get a better assessment of that. Do you think that's a role that actuaries can play in developing that further?
Yes, I think look, you know, within the insurance context, there's definite need for tools, and that's starting to evolve. And that directionally provides indicators of what you can do outside the insurance industry as well. So, you know, some industries are more vulnerable because they hold more records. But similarly, trying to understand why things are vulnerable, because these attacks evolve over time, and the economics evolves over time. So what was profitable to cyber criminals 3 years ago may no longer be profitable. So they've moved on. So building this kind of model may not give you a precise price, but gives you directionally some very important information about what's going on.
And just following up from that, I mean, what do you think of the scorecard of insurers currently of where they're at? So one, do you think they've got the holes in the products that you're talking about and vulnerabilities there in terms of especially aggregate risk? And how do you think they're doing in terms of really quantifying that exposure?
So I think it's early days. I know people have done scans of products and sort of called out, you know, old clauses and things like that. And at the same time, quite a bit of work's gone into developing new wordings and clauses in some industries and in some places to separate them out. But I don't think the long-term picture is entirely clear. As these cyber devices kind of migrate into our everyday lives sort of inexorably, you know, at a personal policy level, whether they are separable.
Hi, I just wanted to check as a consumer of a cyber insurance. Having read the policy, I'm struggling to see when it'll pay out and how it'll pay out. And I just wanted to know, do you have any examples of, you've actually seen these things pay out and what proportion of the actual costs they've paid out in?
So I think the American market's the market with the experience, and that's what everyone's sort of currently basing their risk ratings on, their ratios on, their pricing models on, that sort of thing, simply because that data breach model is where the product's evolved and where the product is still quite heavily focused. So from an Australian perspective, you know, the legislation's coming in tomorrow. You know, wait and see there.
Having looked at it and our risk management framework, I'm seeing it as quite a small mitigant.
Yes.
To our cyber risk, and that, as you say, it's more about all the other things we have in place, and then once we do have a breach, what we do about it and containing it. And I'm just not seeing it form a very big portion, but I might have missed. The policy seems so complex and so many exclusions, it's hard to see how it works.
So I think that's a challenge for brokers in particular, is laying it out as part of a package. It's very much something that slots into and hopefully dovetails nicely with the rest of the coverage, rather than really something you're looking for a standalone.
And that's true. You have seen all of those. I will say there's more value in what they come with. For example, all the investigations and the lawyers that'll come with it.
Yes, but also and the wordings are evolving with time, and the coverages are evolving. And part of the reason they're evolving is people starting to say, you know, I've got a fraud cover, but you know, there's potentially a gap between that and my cyber cover. That kind of conversation. People are, as the world evolves, people are identifying gaps in existing coverages, or exclusions in other countries. Exclusions are being applied, and therefore to clearly carve it out into a cyber cover, which is much more explicit. So there's sort of two things going on. Either it's it's being carried as a silent cover, or people are trying to make it more explicit. So there's a long way to evolve with the cover, let's just say. If Ben was here, he could give you much more detail on that.
You mentioned that there's about a 200-day lag between the breach and sort of detection of it. I hear that, that people are now concentrating on how to detect a breach rather than how to, more so than how to stop it, or perhaps both. But do you see that period of, to detection decreasing rapidly, or is it sort of staying like up around
It's very hard to say. It's one of those things that's likely to swing both ways, and it depends. I mean, that's for data breaches, and it depends on the incentive. So, from a data breach point of view, the longer you remain undetected, the more time you've got to, you know, sell the cards or make use of the information before someone tries to stop you, or before someone cancels the cards or whatever. So, it's useful to think about what the incentives are. So, you know, ransomware, for example, you know, you want the person who's been attacked to know straight away, whereas a data breach, depending on the type of information, so some sorts of information, like medical data, it's very difficult to stop people making use of it because you can't change someone's medical condition, whereas a credit card, you can cancel a card or put some sort of restriction on it. So I don't think it's black and white. I think there are different incentives for different types of data. But I know it's a bit of a non-answer, but I think that's a much more useful way to think about in terms of what the attacker is trying to do with that information. No matter what you're trying to do in terms of detection, they've got different incentives depending on the information. And some of the detection may actually take the form of identifying when they are using that information. So whether it's, you know, alerting with detection system to alert when there's fraud on multiple customers, whether it's something on the darknet or something like that. And so again, it becomes a bit circular. Any questions from this side of the room?
While they're coming up, then I'll go for another one. So is there do you see leaders globally actually trying to seize this opportunity with obviously the reducing motor insurance business potentially with driverless cars? Is this a whole new area, and do you see any insurers really going for it and trying to seize it?
Oh, yeah, I mean, people like Beazley are you know, putting a lot of material out there, trying to develop a brand name, trying to particularly brand the response element, cyber response element. And there's a, you know, again, that works very well at the large corporate end. And to some extent, the Australian market has been seen by agencies as a good diversification versus for something like cyber versus other countries. But again, it's not clear, you know, from a cyber, this is why I'm talking about cyber risk as well as cyber insurance. It's not clear to what extent the, you know, standalone cyber premium will, how long it will endure as a product. So I think that's a challenge for insurers to find a way through there, and where it's a rider, where it's a standalone policy, where it's actually covered, or with sublimits, etc. So, and similarly for reinsurers.
I was actually curious about the date of event of the when the breach has actually happened between. Data event to date of detection in terms of the implications for insurance, because I guess insurance policies cover you for a specified period.
Yes.
And is there risks where, like, for example, the event happens and then you, so how I want to explain this, the difficulty, I guess, in determining when the data event happens and when whether the insurance coverage is purchased for that particular policy outside or within that date of event,
yes,
compared to date of impact. Just sort of curious what sort of, how do they determine?
Yes, and I wish Ben was here because he could remind me whether it's claims made or claims incurred policies. But with a lot of the cyber stuff, there are very often logs unless there's been sort of very wide scale destruction as part of the process. There are very often logs that give quite a lot of detail about what's occurred, when the data was exfiltrated, etc. Or the data itself can actually be quite revealing because you'll have records or transactions going up to a particular date if that's recovered. So the dating itself isn't necessarily a problem, although it may go over an extended period. But for the life of me, I can't remember right now, sorry, whether it was whether they're claims made or claims incurred policies. But it's just in common, same with liability policies. Oh, we have one from the... So the question is, where some software as a service companies are considered as providers for banks or insurers or other large companies, the SaaS provider is required to provide a detailed risk assessment with hundreds of questions. Could there be similar forms used to help price cyber risk products? Ah, Mark. Mark, the answer is yes. You have the usual challenge with any quotation form that the more questions you have, the less likely someone is to get all the way to the bottom of the form. Services like BitSight, who I mentioned before, services like Science, try to help underwriters by kind of starting them off with an initial risk assessment, an external view of the company, and as I sort of showed before, potentially identifying are they running out-of-date servers, unpatched servers, things like that, that are potential risk factors. So they sort of start off with an initial risk assessment before they get further underwriting done. And again, it's a kind of a case of scale. If you're a software as a service provider, you can get the audit done once and provide it to many, many customers. If it's a one-to-one, or you're a sort of a small to medium-sized player, it becomes sort of much more onerous and much more difficult to get across. And again, it becomes a barrier to entry. So it may be a benefit to you if you've got good security or well-documented security to getting through the procurement process. So similar things do exist, but it very much depends on the sort of size and scale of the companies involved.
Do you get any parametric covers rather than indemnity covers, which might help?
I'm not aware of any. No, I don't. I'm not aware of any indices that would be suitable for that at this stage. It's sort of very, very. We're very, very early days in sort of the maturity of this, of the risk of the tools.
Just you mentioned cloud computing briefly. Do you think the shift to cloud computing might potentially create an unsustainable ag risk? So if everybody uses the cloud and the cloud gets hacked, then, So what's the potential out there, I guess?
Yeah, so I suppose I describe cloud as the, put all your eggs in one basket and watch the basket closely. Perhaps a different interpretation of it is you are... Many companies have basically something went on with credit cards and the PCI standard for payment cards, and what it resulted in was lots of companies outsourcing payment services to third parties, so that the company, the retailer, the manufacturer, whatever, never actually held the credit card information in the first place and therefore couldn't be breached and lose that information. In some ways, I see cloud as analogous in the sense that you're outsourcing a lot of the responsibility to someone whose job it is to keep the servers patched, keep things up to date, watch out for vulnerabilities, etc., and they're doing it at scale. Potentially there's some sort of localization in terms of there are multiple data centers and things like that, and so breaches are not necessarily going to be global. It is definitely a point of aggregation, and it's particularly a point of aggregation in terms of business interruption. So I think we've been talking about data breaches and everyone's quite focused on data breaches, but I think business interruption is is something that perhaps hasn't had the airtime from a cyber point of view. It just stops people's businesses. Airlines can't fly because their booking systems are not available. Very, very basic things like that. I'm sure there are people here who've got their building passes on their phones, they've got their VPNs on their keys on their phones, things like that. So at some point, businesses just stop. So it's useful to stop thinking about data breaches all the time, you know, although that's what we've historically insured for cyber risk. But just a basic business interruption, if one of the data centers goes down, and they do go down occasionally, for someone like Amazon, you know, Amazon's Sydney data center goes down, what else goes down with it? And suddenly you discover who's got the cloud running in the back end of their system.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking of AWS, actually.
Yeah.
Everybody would shut down.
Yeah, so AWS in particular is a big aggregation point. And back to our discussion about supply chain, even if you don't use AWS, your suppliers do. And that's if you want to go out and do an aggregation scenario tomorrow, that would be the one I'd pick. I'd go out and say, hey, I've got all these suppliers. Let's assume half of them use the cloud on the back end of their services. Let's assume 40% of them use AWS. And half of them are in Melbourne, half of them in Sydney, you know, one of them goes down. What does it do to your business? So, as actuaries, we want to do something complicated. Start with something really simple you can do on the back of an envelope. I'd say back of a fag packet, but there's not much drawing space left. Something you do on the back of an envelope like that as a thought experiment to say, you know, AWS is spot on, What are your dependencies on cross Pacific internet traffic? You know, again, there's only a limited number of cables. If something goes wrong with one and bandwidth restrictions come in, then it's the long way around and that's a lot slower, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they don't need to be kind of rocket science scenarios to get started.
Brett Riley from Arch. Just an observation. Actually, pardon me, segues quite nicely to that comment. I was just going to make a comment that people in the room may have seen or read an information paper that APRA put out in 2015 on cloud computing or shared computing services in APRA speak. It's worth a good read, and I think it makes it very real for a lot of the people in this room who work in APRA regulated industries. You may not be an underwriter of cyber type risk. I know your presentation is not cloud specific, but it's a policy priority for APRA, as I understand it. In the next little while, I know they're looking more broadly at the things you mentioned on business continuity. So I think it's worth a look from most organisations.
And the other thing to bear in mind, if you're playing with a cyber insurance risk scenario, try and think of one that aggregates with your company's operational risk scenario as well, because that's much, much more interesting conversation. The other one, have a look at the Lloyd's model, the business blackout scenario of the American Northeast Power Grid, and then pick up a picture of the Australian Southeast Power Grid. Now, the Australian Southeast Power Grid's got some fairly specific choke points between the states, and again, an attack on the power grid that disrupted transmission between the states could cause problems. So, cyber is the mechanism, but some of these things are very, very familiar, sort of business continuity, loss of utilities kind of scenarios when it all boils down to it. So don't be intimidated. Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.